From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, we're going to talk about you, your health, doctor's results with Dr. Ralph Moss. It's an amazing story, but here's what's happening. Well, that 6.0 magnitude earthquake that struck Northern California on Sunday morning, bringing down thousands of barrels and bottles of high-priced wine, could not have come at a worse time in the wine country. The region, which has been battling one of the worst droughts in decades, was preparing for a premature harvest. Not good. The country's well-known winemaking region, Napa Valley, was one at the epicenter of the earthquake, responsible for dozens of injuries and damages estimated to surpass $1 billion. And wine that bled out of the cellar floors will make up a hefty chunk of the lost revenue. The valley's more than 900 wineries generated some $13 billion a year for the regional economy. And a strong earthquake struck southern Peru, injuring at least two people and damaging buildings. A house was destroyed. 19 other buildings were damaged, including a hospital. Let's check in with one of the experts. Cal Ori wrote the book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, about our geologist, Jim Berkland. Cal, you and Jim have been talking about a big one on the West Coast. Was this it, or can we expect another one?
He doesn't think there's going. I talked to him last night. He's fine. He lives in Glen Ellen, 15 miles from Napa. He doesn't think that there's going to be a aftershock 5+. He does not think that's going to happen. Of course, I disagree. I'm concerned about foreshocks. Foreshocks, or is this a trigger effect? 44 miles from San Andreas Fault. Remember, 2 weeks ago, George, I told you. I started talking about how long the San Andreas Fault line is, 800 miles. That's what really spooks me. There was two foreshocks before the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, and they were on unknown faults 3 miles near the San Andreas. I do not think that this is the end of it. I'm giving it a two-month window. We're going to see something stronger either in San Francisco Bay Area or greater Los Angeles, Palm Springs, near San Andreas Fault.
Thanks for the great news, Cal. Jeez, what can people do to prepare?
I can't sugarcoat it, and I'm not giving a tight window. I'm not saying 24 hours, freak out. I'm saying, hey, people in California, whether you're a tourist or a native, get prepared. You know, I've got to get more water. I know that for my pets and myself. I live on fault lines up at Tahoe, but duck and cover. I read that tourists ran for the doorway. No, no, no. Duck and cover. Drop, duck, and cover. If you're in your bed and a lot of windows aren't around you, just cover your head with the pillow. Don't get up. I did that in 89, and I fell and cut my leg. Please, no doorways. That's yesteryear. Even the USGS will agree with me on that one.
Cal, we're going to check in with you a little later on. Thanks so much for the information. Researchers say they have found more than 500 bubbling methane vents on the seafloor off the U.S. East Coast. The unexpected discovery indicates that there are large volumes of gas contained in a type of sludgy ice called methane hydrate. There are also concerns that these new seeps could be making unnoticed contribution to global warming. Scientists say there could be about, listen to this, 30,000 of these hidden methane vents worldwide. A coronal mass ejection is heading for Earth. It's not a big one. The relatively slow-moving storm cloud left the sun on Sunday. It looks like it could take 3 to 4 days to cross the Earth's divide. Forecasters estimate a 20% chance of geomagnetic storms. Sony's PlayStation Network was forced offline for much of Sunday by a cyber attack in what appears to be a campaign against several online gaming services. Microsoft's Xbox, Blizzard's Battle.net, Grinding Gear Games are among others who have reported being disrupted over the weekend. In a moment, we're going to check in with the technology expert, Lauren Weinstein, about this and some other issues for a couple hours. An 86-year-old Illinois man with a concealed carry permit fired his weapon at an armed robbery suspect fleeing police last month, stopping the man in his tracks and allowing the police to make an arrest. Law enforcement authorities described the man as a model citizen who helped others avoid being victims at an AT&T store outside of Chicago, where he witnessed the holdup. The man, whose identity was withheld from the press, prevented others from entering the store as well during the theft. Police said the robber harassed customers and pistol-whipped one of them. Since Illinois started granting concealed carry permits this year, the number of robberies that have led to arrests in Chicago has declined 20% from last year, according to police department statistics. Reports of burglary and motor vehicle theft are down 20% and 26%, respectively. In the first quarter, the city's homicide rate was at a 56-year low. Dr. John Lott, author of More Guns, Less Crime. John, you know what? I've seen your statistics, and I've got to say the concealed carry, though it's not the greatest one in the country, may have worked out there in the Chicago area. What do you think? Well, Dr. John Lott is no longer with us. Well, he just disappeared on that. Well, we won't be able to get him back in time because during our news segment, we just move on like crazy. But I got to tell you, the statistics clearly show that concealed carry in various states has reduced crime. And in Chicago, where it has been out of control, the homicide rate at a 56-year low, a 20% decline in the last year. We got him back. So let's go back to him. John, we're bopping around with you here. You with us?
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay,
great. Well, anyways, I was saying that, as you said in your book, More Guns, Less Crime, concealed carry reduces crime, and it seems to be working in Chicago.
Right. Well, I mean, it's still early, and you still only have a relatively small percentage of the population with permits. I guess they have about 68,000 licenses that have been issued, about 30,000 in Chicago. But there have been a lot of stories that have gotten people's attention. Maybe that's had some impact on criminals, too. You have several prominent robberies that have been stopped by citizens with permanent concealed handguns. You have had a couple mass shootings that have been stopped by citizens with concealed handguns. Just a dramatic one in July where four people had left a party. The woman in the party had noticed that somebody had left a beer can on her car, and she picked it up and asked some people if it was theirs, and they were gang members, and they just pulled out their guns and started firing at the four people from the party there. Fortunately, one of the members of the party was a former soldier who had just gotten his concealed carry permit, and he was able to stop the attack. He was able to wound several of the gang members who were firing at them, and according to police, save their lives.
All right, my friend, thank you so much, Dr. John Lott. Sierra Leone's parliament has passed a new law making it a criminal offense to shelter Ebola patients. Those caught face up face 2 years in prison, according to the justices there. So far, 1,427 people have died from Ebola, more than any other Ebola outbreak. Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve chairperson, said the economy was improving, but that the Fed was awaiting more evidence about health of labor markets before deciding when to start raising interest rates there. Rates of new U.S. single-family homes fell for a second straight month in July, but a surge in the stock of properties on the market and a moderation in price increases should help to stimulate demand in the months ahead. Let us hope so. Anyway, it's time for technology, the latest in the tech world. Up next, Lauren Weinstein joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Look, wherever you go, people are talking about technology, whether it's a car that drives itself, specialized ATMs, the way you shop these days, your smartphones, your computers, your tablets. Can't seem to get away with it. So I thought we'd, you know, devote a couple hours today, and then we'll take your calls next hour with Lauren Weinstein. He was involved in the development of the Internet for decades. We turn to him, as you well know, all the time for breaking Internet news. I want to talk with him about this hacking of the Sony PlayStation Network and other game services as well. But we're going to have a fascinating couple hours as we talk about technology. Lauren, always a pleasure. It's good to have you for a couple hours tonight.
Yeah, hi, George. It's always great to be with you. Yeah, we do the news all the time. It's always fun to do the longer form segments here.
Absolutely. I want to get your reaction to one of our campaigns, by the way, and that is to try to get the power grid insulated against an EMP attack from a rogue nation, or to stop it from an X-flare from the sun, which could shut down the grid for God knows how long, Lorne. But we've become so dependent on technology. If that grid goes down, even for a week, people are going to go crazy, aren't they?
Well, remember the day the Earth stood still, the power grid went down for an hour and people went crazy, right?
Yeah.
In the old movie. It's going to be, you know, the reality of it is that hardening the power grid against that, you know, a real serious event like that is really, really difficult because so much of the grid is just old. It hardly works as it is. I mean, so much of it is at capacity, over capacity. I mean, if you've looked in your local substation, you know, lately, you know, the equipment in there looks like it hasn't changed in half a century, often because it hasn't changed in half a century or longer. So how you're going to actually harden that against, you know, a massive overcurrent event of one sort or another, it's pretty tough. We don't even have the money right now to upgrade the grid for basic security kinds of things that we need. So I'm rooting for the sun to, you know, send the flares off in another direction.
Let's hope so. But you know what, Lorne? Saturday, for example, I'm here in St. Louis. The temperatures have been in the high 90s all week, lousy weather. The power went out for 4 hours. And I got to tell you, people went nuts.
Yeah.
And we're just talking 4 hours. You know, refrigerators started to defrost. People couldn't open their garage doors because they didn't understand you have to unclip it.
Right.
Because they're all electronic. I mean, I'm telling you, when a big one hits and the power goes out for weeks to months at end, we're going to have some severe problems.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be too worried about the garage doors. I'd worry more about, you know, basic communications and things because,
absolutely,
you know, once you have, you lose short distance communications, long distance communications. I mean, the thing is, there has not really been a big flare event like that since we've become an electronic technological society. Really,
we've been lucky.
We've been very, very lucky, and so it's very hard to judge what the actual impact would be because there's nothing to compare with. We know that things like that happened back in the 1800s and things like that, but you know, obviously there wasn't as much going on. There was effects on telegraph lines and things of that nature, but it's you know, no comparison with now. We really don't know. Sooner or later, we're going to find out. We're going to find out how bad it really is. But I just don't see the money coming from anywhere to really make significant differences in terms of the grid's capability of withstanding things like that. I just don't know where the money's going to come from.
Okay, we've talked about various hacking episodes over the last several months, Lorne, even longer on different cases. But this latest here, what causes someone to attack a PlayStation network, for crying out loud?
Yeah,
they're playing a game by themselves.
A little segue there, because you know, all this time we've been talking about, well, gee, could hackers take down, or could terrorists take down the power grid, which is, you know, be very difficult to do, but certainly there's ways to do damage. So instead, what are we getting? People are taking down the game grid. I think what's probably going on here is basically you have, you know, people who are, you know, kind of scoring points, you know, with themselves. I mean, there isn't, you know, if a PlayStation network goes down, the world keeps turning and the stars keep, you know, stay up in the sky and everything.
That's right.
But you're able to kind of have some boasting credits there to say, hey, you know, look at this, we took down Sony. And it's not an insignificant kind of event because obviously, these companies put a lot of money in to try to keep those networks up because when they go down, they're losing lots of money every minute, every second. And these systems are built in much the same way as much more important, what I will call much more important systems. So if there were avenues of attack, and I think this was mostly a distributed denial of service attack, I think I heard, the same approaches can be used with much more life critical and system critical kinds of situations. And it means that we really have to, you know, we have to pay attention to this. It's not something just to say, it was just a game network, who cares? These networks all operate in kind of similar ways, so you really do have to pay attention.
How much of all of this is connected via satellite systems?
Not as much as you would think anymore. Most of the, because satellite systems have inherent delay, right? They're not as widely used for conventional communications and internet communications in most parts of the world than they were 10 years ago, or especially 20 years ago. Almost all of the data communications now that we deal with, and phone calls and things in most parts of the world, there are certain exceptions, are on fiber, on undersea fiber cable. And that avoids, obviously there's less exposure in certain ways. You can have very, very large capacities now on multi-mode fiber, and you don't have the delay problems either. So the satellites are there, of course. They're used. There are some countries that do depend on satellite more because they don't have good cable. They don't have cable access, or it's too expensive. There's short-term issues. Satellites are used a lot for emergency data and voice communications, of course, where you don't have other alternatives. But in terms of conventional internet that we're using day to day, and conventional phone calls that we're doing day to day, more and more of those are just over the internet. Of course, we're talking about fiber-based land and submarine cables.
What projects are you working on these days, Lorne?
Well, I try to stay abreast of what's going on. It's sort of a continual merry-go-round of these issues. It's kind of depressing. We see the same things coming up again and again and again. It seems like every time we talk, there's been another password theft
breach. Yeah.
Or another credit card, massive, credit card problem where another company screwed up on their terminals. Obviously, there's still a lot of concern about securing communications, from spying from, one entity or another. It's just a real slow slog. I mean, none of these things happen quickly. We're looking at masses of systems all over the world. You can't just snap your fingers and secure them and make changes. And there's a lot of sloppy software out there, which also makes it very difficult, because a lot of these systems were kind of built on the cheap, and with security and privacy not as the original primary goals. And now retrofitting them is very, very expensive and time-consuming. So you can stay busy forever just on these sorts of things.
Lorne, is the desktop computer going by the wayside, or is it going to be around for a while?
You hear that a lot. And if you look at the sales figures, there's clearly been a major decline in sales of desktop systems to consumers, by and large. So because if you are primarily a consumer of entertainment, for example, and information, that's where you've seen the migration to tablets and phones and game consoles that can be hooked up to TVs, of course, and things like that also, because they're just more effective and they're more multimodal. You can use them for lots of different things. On the other hand, if you've ever tried to do significant amounts of writing or video editing or audio editing or any kind of creative work where you're producing information or programming, any kind of coding and programming, system administration, things like that. Trying to do that on tablets and on phones and things is a quick route to the funny farm.
Sure is.
Most of the time. So desktops are going to have a continuing role in commercial applications, business applications for sure.
I've seen some old TV movies, that still have the big terminals on people's desks,
mm-hmm.
and they look so archaic, Lorne. Oh my gosh!
Yeah, well, that's what we were using. I see those in old movies and things. And I go, oh yeah, an ADS 3360B model 075. Yeah, I remember that green phosphor. Yes, that's what it was. I mean, the slow, the old teleprinters and all of that. It's kind of interesting when you feel like a museum artifact and you're still alive.
I bet there are a few still out there in use, huh?
Oh, yeah. There actually are a lot of them because there's so many legacy systems in use, especially in government. There's a lot of, mainframes are still out there. IBM still sells big mainframes. Obviously, you tend to see modern, flat-screen monitors and things now. But there are definitely old systems buried in basements that there's just been no reason to upgrade them. They churn away 24/7 doing mundane but often important things. And it's amazing how much legacy old equipment is still in use. It's sort of heartwarming in a way.
It sure is. Lawrence, stay with us. When we come back, let's talk more about how we can protect ourselves. Technology on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Lauren Weinstein with us. We're going to take full calls with Lauren next hour. Lauren, let's start with some of the issues at hand. Net neutrality. Would you explain that for all of us, first of all? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, the term is used to cover a lot of different areas now, probably too many to make the discussion simple to explain. But as far as most of us are concerned and where the real focus is right now, net neutrality is generally used to explain the situation where there's concerns about the big ISPs, the dominant ISPs like Comcast and AT&T and Verizon and Time Warner and such. They're being able to control access to the Internet and ultimately the content on the Internet. And the reason this is a problem is because in our country, as opposed to many other parts of the world, these very large dominant ISPs have basically carved up the country into large areas that they control. And there's very little effective competition. So if you look, for example, at a situation like a giant like Comcast combining with a giant like Time Warner, which is what they want to do, they want to merge, you have one company controlling an enormous amount of the Internet and an enormous amount of content for the Internet. So there are proceedings before the FCC right now that were triggered when the FCC, in a move that basically made most of us bash our heads against the wall when we heard it, when the chairman said, well, maybe, we should do these high-speed lanes where you could pay money to get higher-speed access to the Internet. Now, we're not talking about consumers getting access. We're talking about the services that consumers want to reach having to pay the ISP. So, for example, Netflix. This is the classic case where there's been this war going on between Netflix and most of the big ISPs because the big ISPs are demanding that Netflix pay them for the ISP's customers to be able to get decent service from Netflix. And obviously the problem is that when you're talking about, you're going to pay for high-speed lane, well, that means everybody else has the slow lane.
That's right.
Right? I mean, it's a zero-sum game here. So the FCC opened a comment period on this idea of theirs, which has been generally, despised. And they got, a million comments, but apparently they've got more comments about this proceeding than anything they've ever taken comments on since, I guess it's the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl.
I remember that one.
That's the last time they got so many comments. And apparently the overwhelming majority of these are saying, hey, we don't want fast lanes. In fact, we want the ISPs to be required to treat everybody in a fair and equitable way.
That's right.
And so that's really what this is about. What's going to happen, is really unclear. What a lot of people want the FCC to do is basically say that the ISPs are common carriers, that they have to follow common carrier rules. And that's not only important for the services, that we want to access like Netflix or whatever, but it's also important for newcomers to the Internet. So they have a chance to reach consumers without having to be faced with gigantic bills to pay the ISPs. Remember, we're already paying, right? You pay every month for Internet service. I pay every month for Internet service. But the ISPs aren't happy with that, the big ISPs, the dominance. They're saying everybody should pay them. The people we're trying to reach should pay them. In other words, they're trying to play both sides of the game, basically.
And they want more revenue.
They want more control because it's not just revenue, but it's content now. They're not happy just providing Internet service. That's become kind of a loss leader for them in some ways. They want to control the content. They want to control the distribution. Remember, we're talking about companies, Comcast is NBC, right?
That's right.
You know, we've had other mergers that have brought us to this place. So there's still about a little more than 2 weeks. I think September 15th is the deadline that was extended out for public comments on this. So there is still time to bombard the FCC with more comments telling them, hey, we want net neutrality. We don't want special high-speed lanes. We want everyone treated equally on this. And we don't want these giant ISPs controlling the content on the Internet. I mean, you know, it's not just that. I mean, you know, you're looking at situations now where so much of television and telephone even are migrating to the Internet now. So you have these companies that are saying, hey, we want to control which channels are on the Internet, what content is on the Internet, how much it costs for new companies to get access to the Internet. It's just unworkable. So definitely, you know, even if you disagree with me, speak your mind, contact the FCC, go to FCC.gov, and there's pointers there how to leave comments, and do it. Tell them what you think on this.
Lauren, hardly a day goes by where we don't hear a story of something being hacked, whether it's a supermarket, a major retailer, online people, passwords, bank account records taken, and everything else. How in the heck do they break in and take your password, for example? For, you know, I couldn't guess your passwords, Lauren, if you paid me. I mean, I just couldn't do it. How do they do it?
In a word, a lot of these systems are sloppy. I mean, that's really what it amounts to. I mean, first off, we have to face, you know, an uncomfortable truth here. Looking at it technically, the technical term for passwords is awful. Right? Passwords have seen their day. They're dead man walking. People are not good at picking passwords. People are not good at remembering passwords. People tend to use the same password for different services, so that if there's a breach in one service, they've exposed themselves in others. And then you have the systems that are implementing this, the actual systems that are, you know, you're trying to access, that are often done in sloppy ways. They don't protect their passwords properly. They're not encrypting them so that they're sitting there in the clear to be grabbed. They try to encrypt them, but they encrypt them badly in a way that an eighth grader can figure out how to unencrypt. It's just a mess from A to Z. Now the thing is that passwords are like the lowest level of all of this, and there are technologies that are coming gradually and in some places already in use to get us past passwords. And the most important one you can do now, which a lot of places are starting to implement, is two-factor authentication. There'll be different names for it. But what that amounts to is, in addition to your password, you will have already told the service what your cell phone number is, for example. And then when you want to log in, not necessarily every time, but at intervals, there's different ways to do this, it will send you a text message with a code, or it will call you on your cell phone or your regular landline phone with a code, and you will enter that code in addition to your password. And so that ties it to something that you control, your physical cell phone, your physical landline phone.
A lot of banks are doing that now, too.
Yeah, a lot of banks are doing it. Credit card companies are starting into it. It's a little more hassle, but it basically decimates the normal way that passwords are stolen. Now, the next step above that that's only getting started now, but shows a lot of promise, is little security keys. And these are like little tiny, very, very small. They can be USB tokens that you plug into a USB port. And that's an additional level of security, because you have that in your possession. It's on your key ring, or it just sits in your computer. And that's another way. And you can have one of those that could provide the access for a dozen different services and keep them all completely separate and unable to interact with each
Interesting.
Other.
Interesting.
So that's coming down the line.
Would that work on a smartphone, too?
Smartphones present a little problem, because smartphones don't typically have USB ports. So there's work being there's work being done now, for example, where you could either use another computer with that to authenticate your smartphone, like on a one-time basis, by bringing
and just like register it or something.
Exactly, you're registering your cell phone using the key that's in another computer, or possibly through Bluetooth and things like that. There's work being done, obviously, with so many people depending on smartphones now. For this technology to have its full benefit, one way or another, smartphones have to be pulled into that ecosystem.
What a great idea, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and the passwords will still be there, but, you know, in one form or another for quite a while, but they will just be kind of the minor line of defense. That's sort of going to be the thing that if, you know, somehow someone got hold of your security key in your computer, they wouldn't know your password. But in the vast majority of situations, these password breaches are being done by people not even in your city, but often on the other side of the world. And they're not going to have access to your security keys. These are physical hardware tokens.
Now, when these people grab your money illegally, where are they sending it to? And can't they get caught that way?
Yeah, they can and they could if there was, you know, enough cooperation from all these, you know, entities involved. But what typically happens is this kind of money is sent through multiple layers, multiple clearinghouses. I mean, it's like it's a technological equivalent of old-fashioned money laundering. You know, they take the money in ways. And
they wash it everywhere.
They push it all over the place in different ways. It usually will end up in financial systems in places like Russia, you know, and obviously the rest of the world financial community doesn't have a lot of leverage, you know, to get things out of there. And even if they lose, you know, a chunk of it, even if they lose 10% or 25% or whatever, there's still so much left that it's worthwhile. Remember, this is all done on a mass scale, right? It's like with everything else with fishes and things like that, that are phishing emails and things. You only need a relatively small percentage of it to work really well to become very, very wealthy when you're operating on that basis. And, you know, we're making progress. The U.S. Credit card industry is gradually shifting toward the chip and PIN system for credit cards. If you don't have one of those now, you will soon, that have the contacts on the back. They've been using that in Europe for years. That will help reduce problems related to physical use of the card. You know, oddly enough, they're starting off in this country, they're not even using PINs because they're afraid that'll be too confusing. It'll still be a signature only. It won't help with over the internet right now for online purchases, but if you think about the Target breach recently, and it seems like every week there's another one now. In the last couple of weeks, I think there have been two where terminals were contaminated. The credit card, debit card,
yeah.
Terminals were contaminated. Chip and PIN cards will definitely help with that. Not 100%, but a tremendous leap from where we are. And I think the industry has pretty well committed to getting all the old cards converted over to that, I think, you know, in the 2015-2016 time frame.
I've noticed some cards, too, gasoline cards, that you also need the zip code when you're swiping the card. Is that a fail-safe system?
Yeah, it's a low-level kind of, you know, a low-level kind of thing. I don't think it really adds all that much security in most cases. But, you know, I think they do that on the sort of it's better than nothing basis. You'll catch some dummies that way, right? I mean, you know.
Huh.
But the real high-value stuff is done through you know, through the regular bank credit cards, and for those, and you know there's other problems. You know, you're not going to be able to steal that much from a gas pump, right? I mean, there's going to be, if someone tried to make a $1,000 purchase through a gas pump, it's going to raise all kinds of alarms. On the other hand, from Best Buy, it's completely reasonable.
You can get by with that.
Yeah, so it's a matter, and these are very sophisticated operations. They know where to focus their attention.
Well, I was going to say, are there companies out there that, companies now, in foreign nations that are, their business is hacking and stealing?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I think another way to put it would be, are there governments, you know, whose business is hacking and stealing? Can you tell the difference between these companies and the governments in some cases? I mean, there are certainly organizations, let's use that word, who are devoted to, you know, developing these technologies. And in some parts of the world, those organizations have a great deal of support, material and otherwise, from their host governments. Because to do this on the kind of scale that some of them do, you pretty much need, you know, if not government actual support, you need the government looking the other way. So it's a very, you know, complicated situation. And obviously, when you tie in all the issues of surveillance and not just economic factors, but surveillance factors and intelligence factors, it all turns into a kind of interrelated situation. So sometimes it's hard to know the difference. You know, it's not always just about the money. It's also about what can be obtained in terms of intelligence values through similar channels.
I got to tell you, Lorne, it is amazing at how when one industry is created, another one to counteract it is created. You know, your credit cards, online, all of a sudden you have theft. It's just bang, 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 isn't it?
Yeah, well, humans are very creative, right?
I mean, every
opportunity, you know, every niche that could possibly be filled since the dawn of time, you know, there have been people trying to find a way to make a fast buck on it, you know, and the technology has opened up a lot of new opportunities. I think we're kind of, like I said, we're kind of gradually making some key progress here. I think the sooner passwords are gone or certainly de-emphasized, the better off we're all going to be. There certainly are ways to improve and to harden these systems. A lot of it is related to money, right? Because a lot of these companies, like the credit card companies, have tended to take the view, well, you know, it's just not worth spending the money to fix up these systems because we're going to irritate people, and what the hell, we can just spread the fraud cost out in service fees across the entire population of merchants, for example. I think now that laws are starting to be passed to force the issue, that's when we're finally starting to see some improvements.
Amazing. What do you see as, right now, the biggest issue facing people with technology?
The biggest in all technology? I don't think I can answer that, because there's so many different categories. There's all kinds of issues related to healthcare, for example, in technology that don't get talked about as much as they should. We certainly have to be concerned about the whole gamut of privacy and security issues. I tend to put a lot of my focus on those, as you know. It doesn't mean you have to go crazy, but it means to take common sense precautions and take advantage of the things that you can do, just like that two-factor authentication. It's available right now for so many people to use, but relatively few people bother to use it. You know, so if it's available and you don't avail yourself of it, then what can you say? So generally, I think it's a matter of staying informed. If you wanted one thing that people can do, you have to stay informed about this. You can't be complacent. You can't be blasé. If you are, you're good as it gets steamrolled, one way or another.
Really?
Yeah.
What is new? What's down the pike in terms of technology that folks can use?
Well, certainly there's a big push now toward mobile, right? I mean, it's clear, no matter how you look at it, that in terms of consumption of information, it's all moving toward mobile, and the mobile networks are getting faster and faster. You know, most of them are moving toward LTE systems now, but this again kind of takes us back to the net neutrality issues, because they apply at least as much in terms of their importance to mobile networks than they do to landline networks, because the restrictions on what people can do with mobile phones tend to be even more onerous. So I think most of the big developments that people are going to see in communications anyway, that they're going to notice the most, are going to be in the vast increases in the capability of these mobile systems and you know, smartphones and applications. But, you know, to get the full benefit of those, we're going to have to make sure that we do have net neutrality and keep the ISPs from basically treating us like peons, you know, one way or another.
Lauren, people want to get a hold of you or monitor what you do? Give us some sites.
Really, just going to vortex.com is the easiest thing to remember, VORTEX.com. And there's links there to most of my other stuff.
Vortex. All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take phone calls with Lorne Weinstein for the final full hour with him. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Always sending out some great information about that as well. And you can do all that by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Those little icons you'll find up there at the far right-hand corner. And make it a point to go to the website at least a couple times during the day, in the morning and then later on right before the show as it's updated for the evening's festivities. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.